Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Lynn Hugo, author of Mothers of Fate. Now, Lynn is a prolific author based in Ohio. She is the recipient of multiple fellowships, including from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, and repeat grants from the Ohio Arts Council. Her 2005 memoir, Where the Trail Grows Faint, A Year in the Life of a Therapy Dog Team, won the Riverteen Literary Nonfiction Book Prize, and she has received a number of other awards. She's also used her writing prowess to teach creative writing to hundreds of school children through the Ohio Art Council's Arts and Education Program. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Lynn.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your having me.
Now, Mothers of Fate is a novel, correct?
Yes.
And are some of your other books, you've written both nonfiction and fiction.
I've only written the one creative nonfiction, which was
Where the
everything else. Well, my first two books were poetry, but since then, I have to put these caveats in there.
Okay. So did you start out as a poet? Did you start out as with a, you did, and then you went to memoir?
I followed the two books of poetry with a novel, maybe two, and then did the creative nonfiction, which just kind of grew organically out of what was going on in my life, you know, and then went back to fiction.
Okay. And it looks like looking at your website, which is LynneHugo.com for someone who wants to check it out. Looks like you might even have a children's book.
Yes, I do.
Wow. So how long have you been writing?
Oh, well, I mean,
your whole life?
Yes. Since I was a child, but publishing my first. I'm not sure I can remember when the first book of poetry was published. In the mid 90s, the first novel was 98.
Okay.
And that was made into a movie.
What was that called?
Well, the novel was titled Swimming Lessons, and as happens when you have movie rights sold, you really lose all control, or at least that's what happened. And the novel is about the friendship between women and the importance of it. And then the Hearst Entertainment sort of redirected that and retitled or titled the movie Another Woman's Husband, which, as you can see, really changes the changes the suggestion of what it's actually about.
What was that process like for you? I mean, it must have been so exciting to your first novel. It's being made into a movie, and then it's not what you expect at all.
Well, it's very, very much a wake-up call, or an education. I'll rephrase that. It was an education.
Oh, I bet.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what Mothers of Fate is about and why you wanted to write this book.
Well, all of my fiction grows out of some social concern, some social issue about which I am passionate. Although I never, ever write polemic. There's usually a great deal of research that goes into it. And it is, my emphasis is on the story, not on convincing anybody of anything. But I do like the idea that people, something that my readers have said often is, I always learn so much from your novels. There is a lot of research that goes into them. And so in this novel, I hesitate to call this one a social issue, but the social phenomenon is adoption, and particularly in this case, closed adoption, which means that there's no knowledge on the part of the birth parent or parents and the adoptive family or the adopted child of each other's identity beyond usually an exchange of, or not an exchange, through them and through the intermediary, which is often an adoption agency or an attorney, that there's health issues or not the lack of health issues generally.
Right.
Effective in the 90s, open adoption became quite common. And I think that is probably the prevailing mode now for adoption. But people who are adults now who were adopted are more often were more often adopted in a closed adoption situation. And so I wanted to look at that and what that is like for the birth parents and for the adoptee and for the adoptive parents.
Now, do you have personal experience with adoption?
Yes, one of my children is adopted.
Ah, okay.
This is in no way my family story. Mm. I don't do that. I don't use people that I know, or I'm also a licensed therapist, and I would never use a client's story. That would be entirely unethical. So I have a good ear for dialogue. I have a very good ear for dialogue, and that's from being a very trained listener. But again, I never use anybody that I personally know as a basis for a story.
But there must be times where things from people you know kind of, there might be some characteristics or some, are you saying you don't use anything? Because most writers will say everybody is.
Not their story.
Not their
story. Human dynamics.
Yes.
Human dynamics.
Okay.
Yes, very, absolutely human dynamics, how relationships work, definitely, yes.
Yeah. So now in this story, you have a woman who really did not want to give her child up for adoption, and this was in the 1980s? 83, which was a time when it was starting to be more common for a single mother to keep a child and raise it on their own, but still not like it is today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also in the case that I depict in the novel, it was during the recession, the 80s, the recession in the 80s. She lost her job. And she had become disabled.
And that made it especially tough. And she did not have family support.
She did not, exactly. So there are, yes.
Yeah.
And she has been enormously filled with regret, which I think there were certainly instances in which a woman felt as though she had no options.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And that probably still happens.
Yeah. Probably less frequently now, you know.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
Completely.
And, you know, I haven't really said this very publicly before, but, you know, I was a young mother. I was a teen mom in the late 1970s. And, you know, one of the things that I was always grateful for was, to be honest, the fact that abortion was legal. Now, I chose not to do that. I chose to marry the father. I chose to have the child. But I was very grateful that I had a choice.
Yes.
And then I didn't feel trapped because I'd had it, because it was my choice.
Yes. And that's one of the things that the character, the lead character, were one of the protagonists in this novel, who's she had the choice too, and she was very pressured by her parents to have an abortion because, of course, it was legal, but she chose not to. So, yes, choice is a very big theme in this book.
Yes. And then, but there is a tendency today, I think, for people to think, well, women should just choose to have a baby and give it up for adoption because that's best for everybody. But it's can be very, very, what would you say? It can have an impact on people's lives forever. It's not always the best choice.
Of course not. There's no single choice that's always the best choice.
Yeah.
It's a very, very personal. I completely agree with you about that.
Yeah.
And it's not a choice that I think any outside person, or this is my personal belief, or state can make, can impose, can or should impose on a woman.
I absolutely agree. I've known women who've made all the choices, and sometimes it was the right choice for them, sometimes it wasn't, and there's all, but there's always consequences no matter what choice you make, you know, and there's always regrets no matter what choice you make too.
Yes. It reverberates through your life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It does. Yeah. And you live with it.
So in Mothers of Fate, you've got the birth mother, you have the adoptive family, and then you have an attorney who gets involved in this 30 years after the fact.
Right.
And in some ways, it's as much her story as any of the others.
Very much so.
And why did you choose to do it that way?
Well, she is also an adoptive mother.
Right.
And so it's a very emotional, she is absolutely, for her own reasons, she becomes extremely committed to helping the character. The birth mother's name is Dina. And the attorney's name is Monica, ironically.
Yep.
And Monica's wife is named Angela. And the adoptive parents are Jenny and Brian. All right.
Yes.
So Monica has her own reasons. I don't know if you want me to go into that, but
well, it's up to you how many spoilers you want to give.
Exactly. another theme in this book is the reverberations of workplace sexual harassment and abuse, and how those power differentials, and how that has affected women. So, and how did that play in Dina's situation, the birth mother? How did that play in Monica's life, which makes her extremely committed to helping Dina?
Right.
As a mediator, what Dina wants is for her to find her birth son. And Angela, Monica's wife, for her own reasons, which are entirely personal, just loses it when Monica tells her about the case and says, no, you absolutely can't do this. Because Angela is a social worker who was a foster child, who was adopted as an older child, but she had been shunted all over. And finally, the state had taken her away from her birth mother. And she had had wonderful adoptive parents. And she said, this is totally wrong. The only person that ever has the right to search is the adoptee, never, ever the birth parent. That's just wrong. So it becomes very...
Yeah, I had a little bit of hard time with how hard-nosed Angela was about that. I felt like she wasn't, and you do a good job in the book of showing that maybe she wasn't being fair and balanced in this, and that there were more perspectives but I was a little upset with her.
Yes. Well, my intention there was to illuminate how our past experiences shapes how we respond to situations in our present that we may not even be aware of how. I don't know if you recall how Kathy, Angela's friend, said to her, you know, you're not being fair.
Yeah.
To your wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody who didn't have the same lens could see that.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. But that does happen, that people just kind of go off the rails in their reactions.
Well, it's obviously a very delicate subject.
And people do get very passionate about, is this all right to do?
Yeah. Yeah, I had of course, so this book is set 30 years after 1983. So that
Yes.
puts it in 2013. And that's
Correct.
Before really 23andMe, Ancestry.com, so forth were so prevalent. And because nowadays, a lot of these secrets are coming out as a result of people finding that they are or are not related to other people.
And, you know, my own reaction to that is I don't think people really have the right to blow up other people's lives that way.
Yeah.
I think that there can be a lot of, well, of course, you have to have put your DNA in that database.
Right,
and
right.
You never know what's going to happen to it. And I think that's probably a very risky thing to do.
Well, I will say I had an experience a couple of years ago where someone had contacted my son and said, "Did you have any relatives in Kansas or Missouri? I was given up for adoption in the 1950s. I'm trying to find my family," and he didn't. My son responded, but never heard back, and we weren't really sure. But I figured it was his dad's side of the family, because there were more of them, and it was in Iowa. And half of my family was from the East Coast; the other half was Iowa. But, and then later I put mine on there too, and turned out he was related to me. This person was related to me, and almost certainly a cousin, a first cousin.
Wow.
Well, and through my mother's side, they had gotten where they could tell you which side of the family it was. Well, my mother only had one brother. And so I went home when I got back to my mom's the next time, and I said, "Hey, Mom, is there a chance that your brother had a child that was given up for wedlock?" And she goes, "Yeah, he did." And this was like, you know, 70 years later. And we reached out to my uncle. My mom wasn't really, she didn't want to call him. And I, what I had told this person is I would find out and I would contact him, contact my uncle and ask if he wanted to be, you know, wanted to be in touch. And it actually took a little bit to get a hold of my uncle, and he was so thrilled. He was so thrilled to find this son. He never knew what had happened with what had happened at all. He had no knowledge. The parents had taken care of everything. He was in college, maybe sophomore year in college or something. The girl was in high school. The parents had gotten together, his and hers, and taken care of everything. And he and this guy, it's so, there were so many similarities in, like, he became a doctor. My uncle was a dentist, you know, so his son became a doctor. And it was just really interesting. And they did end up meeting and getting together and being very happy that it happened.
That's good. I mean, there are a lot of happy stories, too.
Yeah, yeah.
There are other stories that are where people get very upset.
Yeah.
So I'm glad your story was so positive, which sounds very positive.
Yeah,
story.
And I, like I said, I wasn't going to put them in touch if my uncle had any reservations about it, but he did not. He was very happy.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with Mothers of Fate, the adoption of this child that had been given up in 1983 was not all that smooth.
The
adoptive parents were great, but, you know.
Well, like all parents, I'm sure they made mistakes and later tried to own them. I think like a lot of adopted children, Daniel, that was his name, or that is his name in the book, he had a lot of difficulty adjusting to being adopted. He felt very different from his adoptive parents. And that's a fairly common feeling or struggle for adopted kids. I have worked with, I used to be the clinical director of a county agency for troubled youth and their families. And I've been in private practice. So what I'm getting at is I have worked with a number of adoptees and their families. And I'm trying to remember. Yes, I have worked with some birth parents. And what I'm aware of is just that dynamic that adopted children or teenagers often have. So that's what I was going on.
And Daniel, the young man who was adopted, thought he didn't want to know who his... He did and he didn't, right?
He was very angry.
He didn't want to know, but then he did want to know because he wanted to know why. And I would feel like, I would think that would be very hard not to wonder why, what happened, why did my birth parents give me up? And to think to hope that there might be a really, really good reason that was beyond anybody's control. Which in a way there was in this situation.
There definitely was.
Yeah.
There definitely was. I agree with you. I think that often the older the adopted person gets, the less that is an issue. It tends to be in adolescence that I've seen that it is most difficult when they feel the most different and the most Identity issues are, that's when kids are struggling with identity issues to begin with.
Right. And now the birth or the adoptive parents at one point, you know, they had gone by the advice that it's best to just make it clear from the beginning, not try and keep it secret that they were adopted. But then they thought maybe that wasn't the best idea. Do you have a feeling about that?
Well, if it, you know, I really don't, because I have some sympathy for that notion that if it weren't in the child's mind to struggle with, maybe they wouldn't struggle so much.
And yet
everything we know is that secrets are a problem.
Because if they get found out,
sure,
then it's so much worse.
I couldn't advocate for that.
Yeah.
I just couldn't.
Yeah, that's a good point. So why don't you read a little bit from Mothers of Fate for us, Lynn?
I'd be delighted to do that. All right. This is from the prologue. Prologue, Mercy Hospital, Pittsburgh, 1983. I didn't lose everything. I'm still Dina, and I still know what was true. We ate. A flask passed between us. A good presence was there that I took as blessing. The locust songs. I don't know if he heard them, but I did, and said nothing. I believed they didn't matter. Winter wouldn't matter. This is true. The sky was an inverted black stoneware bowl with a white ship moon. We laid in a field on the stadium blanket kept in the trunk of his car, white splotched with the crust of liquid stars that had fallen through May, June, July, August. My ragged breath through his name as I cried, Tony, like yes, or love, or mine. I heard myself. And the yes, there was no need to speak. The yes, I chose to speak. A promise. Over his shoulder, above me, the brim of eternity. Tomorrow, tomorrow. We each said it. I heard him. So then I'm going to go to section one of the book, which is titled Destiny, and chapter one, and this is Pittsburgh, 2013. It usually works best if you tell me what you want. Monica leaned over her desk and smiled at the new client, trying to put her at ease. She was in the habit of staying behind it, a personal safety thing with her, particularly with men. But that was hardly an issue with Dina Wilkes, a woman at least 20 years older and so disabled as to make her lurch with a metal crutch, the forearm kind. She considered moving them both to the conference table, but her laptop sat open there and the briefs she'd been reading before court were hastily raked together like a messy pile of leaves. Dina had been early for the appointment. Beside, it would be awkward now. May I ask a personal question first? Monica tilted her chin. She didn't like it when a client started down that path. That depends on how personal it is, she said, keeping her tone airy. Do you have children? Slight nod, no invitation in it. A daughter. Then her eyebrows went up just enough. Okay, sorry. A long hesitation then that Monica waited out. I've never talked about this to anyone. I don't know how. I wish I could take it all back, Dina said. I'd rewind to the first yes I ever said to Tony Hamilton, before anything was inevitable. Dina's gaze went to her hands, clutching one another in her lap, and Monica looked at them too. They were veined, knuckles prominent. Finally, Dina looked up as if expecting a question.
Monica didn't ask any, but nodded. And as Monica had learned was likely to happen, the client went on. Some people ended up talking to their lawyer with about the same level of reserve as they did their psychologist if they had one. And if they didn't, the lawyer ended up serving the purpose, in Monica's experience. That wasn't necessarily a good thing, was also her experience. Once they told her what they really wanted, it was a fix for their minds and hearts. No lawyer could do that. But the time she hadn't heard the whole story had come back to bite her, and it took time and patience up front. She needed clients badly. She had time, way too much of it. But patience. Patience for these tangled human dramas, like vines that put out shoots taking root here, there, and seem to have no clear beginning and even no end. Monica was working on that kind of patience. "He was my boss," Dina said. Her hair was mainly a pale, dingy gray, wavy, blunt cut, with nothing to soften it. No makeup to ease the sooty smudges beneath her eyes, or perhaps darken what likely were once good eyebrows, now too faded to bring attention up to nice hazel eyes and away from the deep parentheses around her mouth. A short nose. Dina continued speaking as Monica cataloged these details. "Tony had an office with a window and a big wood desk, something like yours, in fact, and a phone with a whole row of buttons. I had a cubicle, a typewriter, and an intercom. We worked at an insurance company, which turned out to be ironic. His eyes and brows and his hair were dark brown, but his skin was fair, and his nose was thin and elegant. Handsome. Not like a movie star, because his teeth weren't so straight." Dina smiled then, and Monica noticed that Dina's teeth were even and fairly white. "Anyway, he was 35. Nice. Fairly handsome. Maybe I flirted. Oh, I did flirt. My fault. But then things were different in 1983. You wouldn't know this, but 30 years ago, we all flirted back and forth at work. But it was jokey and harmless, never likely to make it from anyone's desk, even to the water cooler. Now, there were a couple of higher-ups." She stopped, seeming to study the gold titles printed on the spines of Pennsylvania law books, but then went on with a shoulder shrug. "A couple of big bosses made their secretaries' lives a living hell, pawing them." Monica thought she hadn't moved and kept her face neutral, but realized she must not have when Dina went on, because she said, "Oh, they were different. She had an almost apologetic tone. "I'm talking about the regular men. With them, it was all just fun and none of us worried. Not about that, I mean. We were worried about losing our jobs because of the recession. But, you know, I was flattered when Tony found reasons to stop by my cubicle. He was one of the good ones, and I figured it didn't hurt that my boss liked me. I mean, he was my boss and all." Dina stopped again and looked at Monica, her hands clasped in her lap. "Yes," Monica thought. "Damn. I know about wanting the boss to like you. No, needing the boss to like you. Thinking he's okay." Monica hesitated and then said, almost too quietly, "It wasn't your fault." "But women always blame ourselves, themselves." "Does all this sound worn out, make you tired, like you think you know what's going to happen?" "Yes, you do. And you don't, not at all. I promise, you just don't."
And that was Lynn Hugo reading from Mothers of Fate. Now, fate and destiny is another theme of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. Tell me how that plays out.
Well, honestly, I thought about that a lot, because in my office, over all the years I've been practicing, I have heard so many references to people saying, you know, "We were meant to be. He or she was my soulmate."
it was like destiny. And then, you know, somehow it all fell apart. And that idea has always intrigued me, that so many people believe that someone or something is literally their destiny. I don't mean to sound sarcastic about that. I mean, it's a very firm belief,
yeah,
that so many people hold. And so I wanted to examine that in the novel and contrast it with the notion that everything is the result of our choices. And so I want to share this, if it's all right with you.
Of course.
I have two epigraphs in the book. The first one is from William Shakespeare. It is the stars above us govern our condition. That would be destiny.
Right.
Right. And then Copernicus said, more stars in the north are seen not to set, which in the south, while in the south, certain stars are no longer seen to rise.
Hmm.
So there's the belief and there's
yeah,
a sign saying, well, wait, these stars have stopped setting and these stars aren't rising anymore. They've disappeared. So I wanted to contrast those.
For Dina, the idea of Tony being her destiny was really quite important to her, but then she also acknowledges that it was her choices that led her into that.
Yes, she does, because she says, I wish I could unsay the first yes.
Yeah. So how did that influence her life, this idea of destiny?
Well, she became so caught up with Tony that, and her conviction that they were destined to be together, that she proceeded to make this absolute commitment to him.
Right, to have this baby. And
yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then, as I was saying, that had something to do with the intensity. She saved money all these years. All this time, the 30 years, she waited and waited and waited until she had the money and the where, which is the total, I don't want to give too much away, but the total wherewithal to hire a mediator. And she wanted to do it, which she felt was the right way, so that he would have the choice.
Right, right.
But he said to Monica at some point, I need to know if I was right, that there was a reason, that this really was like, well, we weren't meant to be together, but there was this destiny, and I just didn't really understand what it was about.
Mm, yeah.
That I thought it was me and Tony, essentially, but no, it was really my son.
Mm. So do you feel like, it's kind of hard to talk about this book without giving away spoilers. It really is. So maybe we should talk more about your writing process. So, Lynn, when you get an idea for a novel,
yes,
do you start with the characters, or do you just start with the theme and then find the characters?
I usually have some story idea, and I'll tell you were asking me. Sometimes I get it from the newspaper. Like, the next novel I have coming out in the late 26 is on opiate addiction. But the one I'm working on right now is on medical ethics. And that comes straight out of the newspaper. Do you remember a few years ago
it was maybe 4 years ago, a hospital, the story was that what they had transplanted a kidney into the wrong patient. And it was on the national news. And I got really interested in that. And I started doing some research. Well, it turns out it's happened 5 times in the United States.
Wait, how? How does that happen?
Exactly. So I got really interested. And I thought, okay, if it can happen by accident, could it happen on purpose? Well, there's a story, right?
Yes.
How does it happen? And so I've been researching and researching and researching. So that's the novel I'm working on. I'm currently working on that one.
Wow.
So then you construct a scenario in, and then you create the
characters come out of the scenario. Yeah.
And sometimes it's something like one of my very popular novels was The Testament of Harold's Wife. Maybe that's 2014. I'm not positive, but that one came out of newspaper also because I saw that maybe not 2014, maybe that I'm sorry. I don't remember the year. I'm so sorry.
You just have so many books.
I'm just not good with remembering publication dates.
No, you do. You have so many books. So it'd be hard to remember all of when they all came out.
I didn't mean it that way. I just meant I really am not good with remembering dates. So it was, I had seen in the paper that the administration in power at the time had removed the ban on trophy hunting of exotic animals or bringing them back to the United States.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a prominent person was, there was a big picture of him.
Yes.
And
the Jimmy John's guy. It was somebody like that, wasn't it? Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha.
And posing with I believe it was an endangered animal also, that it was, I believe this happened in Africa, but he was bringing this trophy back to the United States. And that was now okay because this ban on bringing these trophies back into the States had been lifted. Well, I'm not a fan of trophy hunting, killing for sport.
Right.
But I understand that there are a lot of people that are fine with that. It just happens to be not something that I am good with. And I, at the time, I wanted to write a novel, I wanted to have an older woman protagonist who was really feisty and really sarcastic and just very independent. So I created this widow who was just very sassy, very sassy. And I put her out in Indiana on a rural farm and gave her chickens and a tuxedo cat that she talks to. And God help the guy that went trophy hunting on her property.
Whoa.
So that was titled The Testament to Harold's Wife. And that did very well. So I just, sometimes it's just a kind of an issue that you want to create a scenario around it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like most of your books, there's some kind of, like you say, social or some issue that's at the root of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have to look at, oh, The Language of Kin. The protagonists are two zookeepers. And one of them is has become convinced that zoos are not morally or ethically acceptable, especially for the great apes, because of how they live in the wild and their intelligence level and their they use tools, they parent cooperatively, that all those things. As I did a ton of research, and the other one has a very strong argument that we are destroying their habitat due to human greed, and the only way to conserve species is to have
zoos.
Sustainable.
And where do you come down in that argument?
Sanctuaries. I'm very interested in human communication and human animal communication. So I did just a huge amount of research on that in that area. And that came out of that novel, The Language of Kin.
Wow.
Came out of that. So, yes.
Yeah. So, like with Mothers of Fate, you had this, you wanted to write about adoption. And
particularly closed adoption.
About closed adoption and how the impacts that that can have on the participants in it, even many years later, how, you know, the impact can be. And did you know, like, do you plot out the story? You know where it begins and where it ends when you start? Or do you you have this concept that you want to write about and you some characters develop around that and then you just start writing and see where they go?
I construct a story arc with an opening, rising action, climax, falling action, denouement. So I do it almost as though it's a theater piece. And then I divide it into chapters. And I usually get to the climax and falling action. And I always think, okay, I know how this is going to end. And I'm always wrong.
Oh.
Because it changes. As I write it, I get, and so I've kind of given up plotting out the ending because I mean, I think I know where it's going. And then the characters just say, oh, yeah, that's the good luck with that movie. that is not what we're doing. We're just like, that was a terrible idea, Lynn. We're not doing that.
And when you get there and the ending changes, does that make you sometimes have to go back and rewrite things, take things out, add things in to make the ending make more sense?
Yes, but not usually a lot. Usually I just haven't seen
the hints, the foreshadowing's all there. You just didn't know it.
Yes. As I said, the characters are saying, boy, are you dumb? Because it's like, we tried to tell you we were doing that.
You know, do you remember back in like high school English class when you had to take a story and you were analyzing it and you were looking for the foreshadowing and you were looking for all these things? And I remember the time thinking, I wonder if the author even knew what they were doing. I doubt if half the time this was even intentional.
Yes. Well, yes, of course, in the revising and editing process, then it's very intentional. So you could have told you could have argued with the teacher, and the teacher, if he or she had experience in it, would say, well, yes, but there's always the revision and the editing process. And then the author would have been very aware of it, because if it wasn't in there, if there was no basis for this action or this character development or this character, you can't have a character change dramatically, you know, like all of a sudden.
Right.
One thing I never do, ever, is tie up an ending with a big red bow, the happily ever after. I just don't do that because life is just not, I write realistic fiction and there's never a, okay, that's the end and things didn't change after this and it was all happy. It's like, I wish it were. I wish it were, but it's not. It's
do like, you really wish it were though? Because wouldn't that be boring?
Well, yes, I think you're right. I never leave a reader without real hope. Mm. I never do a hopeless ending, but I never like tie up everything so that you know exactly what's going to happen and exactly the whole future.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it because, like I said, it's, you know, the idea of life being this smooth, happy thing, it's just, people get bored when things are too easy.
Maybe that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not telling you, my father died when I was only 22.
Oh.
And I had a really, really vivid dream about him a few years after that, where I felt like he came to visit me. And what he told me in this dream about life after death was, he said, the problems aren't all solved. We still have things, you know, we still have challenges. The difference is that nobody fights about God anymore.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I kind of believe that. That's true, that even in the afterlife, that it's not all, you know, angels and harps and floating around, because what fun would that be, really?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's very profound.
Yeah.
That'd be neat to use it in a book. I wonder if I could have your...
Yes, you may.
That's really profound.
Well, thank you, Lynn. By the way, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Lynn Hugo, author of Mothers of Fate and quite a few other books. So, Lynn, how did you first start publishing?
Well, when I first started publishing, I was writing poems because the kids were little and I was working full time and I just didn't really have time for anything. I mean, you can do, or I found, I should say, not you, but because it only applied to me, I'm sure, but I couldn't really focus. I was writing lyrics and I could do that in the kind of time frames that I had available.
Mm.
Or not very long, you know.
Yeah,
And they weren't really long lyrics either. And I started submitting to literary magazines, and my first publication was in the Cimarron Review, which is a really, really fine literary magazine, and I was so shocked, you know. I just kept submitting and. Then I applied for an Ohio Arts Council grant and I got one. And so I was just very fortunate. So it was very encouraging. And then as the kids got older, I wrote some narrative poems. I started stringing them together so that the narratives, some of the lyrics and the narratives together created a story. Started, and I was always a big reader, and I don't really know how I got.
So the first novel, I mean, that's, to break into publishing as a novelist, some people have a very easy path, but for a lot of people it can be quite a struggle. Was it, which was it for you?
Well, I had at the time a really wonderful writing partner named Anna Tuttle Villegas. And I met her, I was looking for an agent, and the agent gave me her contact as a reference.
Mm.
And I called her, and so I did end up signing with that agent. And I learned a lot from her, because she already had a novel published, and we started working on one together. And that was the one that was made into a movie.
Okay.
And
how did that work, to write a novel together?
We used a fax machine, faxing actors back and forth. This was a long time ago.
So would you write a chapter and then fax it to her, and she'd write a chapter, yes, and then fax it back?
And then we'd edit each other's.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
Yes. And I don't think she has published anything since. I mean, any novels. I'm sure she's published short stories, but I'm not aware that she has published any novels. And she's a really gifted writer. And so since then, I've really been fortunate to have made friends with some other wonderful writers and we trade work. And I'm probably not answering the question you asked me anymore.
Oh, no, that's fine. But it's like, actually, the fact that you were able to get an agent before you even had a novel, you know, as a poet, that you were able to get an agent is pretty amazing.
I had completed a novel.
Okay.
That I was submitting.
Okay.
That
makes more sense.
Yes. I was looking for an agent for the novel that I had written. And that novel was ultimately published. Tara Gavin ended up buying that novel with Next Books, which that ended up being published. I loved my title. The title was originally An Endurable World, and Next Books, which was Harlequin's attempt for, I think, maybe about 5 years at doing a literary imprint, which they ended up folding. Tara Gavin was my editor, and she's wonderful. And we're still very good friends, and she's read for me, and she's been just...
So what did they change the title to?
The Unspoken Years.
Okay.
Which, I just love Endurable World a lot better.
Yeah. Well, Lynn, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And
well, thank you so much, Monica. You've been wonderful.
Oh, thank you. We always close with a quote, and of course, adoption seems to be the topic that makes sense for this. And the quote is from an unknown source, but it says, "Giving birth does not make a mother. Placing a child for adoption does not make her less of one."
Oh, I really like that. That's a wonderful quote. Thank you.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much for having me, Monica. I really appreciate it.